Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Totally Driven Entertainment Radio Network.
In the future, none of you are heroes.
You're legends.
Get driven. Stay driven.
Welcome to the Bareback Facts. I am your host, Dallas Big D, and I am here to take you all on a journey into the Hell House. And guys, I've got to tell you, over the last couple of days, I've received requests to do more dark and macabre things on my show. And I thought to myself, let's do it. So without further ado, we're not going to waste any time at all. Today, we're talking about Dr. H.H. Holmes, a man considered by many to be one of the first documented serial killers in American history, a man documented for his cruelty and greed. And so today, let's take a step into the darkness. Before we do, as always, guys, I want to remind you that our call-in number is 718-508-9883. And if you feel at any time during my show that you might be too terrified to call in anyway, because I want to hear you scream. Now, I want to make it perfectly clear that at no time am I going to condone the actions of our horrifying object of discussion today, but I do want to make it abundantly clear that today we are talking about sensitive material, and in the coming weeks we shall continue to do so. So, let's dance. Dr. Holmes was born in 1861 in New Hampshire. His name, however, is not Dr. H.H. Holmes. This is the alias that he used during the 1893 Columbian Exposition, during which he lured his victims into his own twisted and sick creation, a place called the Murder Castle. His real name was Herman Webster Mudgett, and he was born May 16th in 1861. Incidentally, he would die on May 7th of 1896, 9 days before his birthday. But he's best known as Dr. H.H. Holmes. Holmes was known for trapping, torturing, and murdering people who became guests at his Chicago hotel, which he opened for the 1893 World's Fair. He was born in Gilmanton, New Hampshire, son of Levi Horton Mudgett and his wife, formerly Theodate Page Price. His early criminal career was based on fraud and forgery, including a cure for alcoholism, real estate scams, and a machine that purported to make natural gas from water. Holmes himself had earned a doctor's degree from the University of Michigan, once again proving for us over in Ohio, you can't trust people from Michigan. Shots fired, guys. Anyway, on July 8th, 1878, he married a woman by the name of Clara A. Lovering of Alton, New Hampshire. And on January 28th in 1867, he married, bigamously by the way, Myrta Z. Belknap in Minneapolis, Minnesota. There, they had a daughter named Lucy. He filed a petition for divorce from his first wife after marrying his second, but it never became final. He then married his third wife, Georgiana Yoke, on January 9th of 1894, and was also the lover of a woman by the name of Julia Smith, the wife of Ned Connor, one of his most trusted associates. And she is particularly important to the story because she becomes one of his earliest victims. Now, through various associations that he had made and various connections that he did, achieve during his time, he managed to secure a Chicago pharmacy by defrauding the pharmacist and built a block-long three-story building on the lot across the street. He called this building the Castle and opened it as a hotel for the World's Columbian Exposition in 1893. Apologies, exposition, not expedition. The bottom floor of the castle contained shops, the top his personal office, and the middle floor a maze of over 100 windowless rooms in which he would lure unsuspecting souls to their inevitable and painful demises. Now, over a period of 3 years, Holmes selected female victims from among his hotel guests and tortured them in soundproof and escape-proof chambers fitted with gas lines that permitted Mudgett to asphyxiate the women any time he saw fit to do so. Holmes had repeatedly changed buildings and builders, I should say, to ensure that no one truly understood the design of the house that he had created, who might report it to the police. Bodies went by chute to the basement, where they were either sold to medical schools or cremated and placed in lime pits to conceal the evidence of his grisly crimes. Now, following the World's Fair, Holmes left Chicago and apparently murdered people as he traveled across the country. But this is not the end of the story. Following the World's Fair, Holmes would leave Chicago. Of course, as I said, but he did so out of boredom, trapping people in his castle had become too easy. He's been known as one of the most prolific murderers in history. He only confessed to 27 murders over the course of the interrogations, but only 9 could be plausibly confirmed, and several of the people who he claimed to have murdered were still alive. He's commonly said, however, to have killed up to 200 people. This figure, however, is only traceable to the 1940s pulp magazines that made him incredibly infamous after his time. Many of his victims were said, the majority of his victims, I should say, were said to have been killed in a mixed-use building which he owned and located, the building we talked about, the Castle. This building lay only 3 miles west of the 1893 World's Fair Columbian Exposition, supposedly called the World's Fair Hotel, and commonly, or informally, called the Murder Hotel, though evidence suggests that the hotel portion of his building was never truly open for business. Besides being a serial killer, as you may have already guessed, Holmes was a brilliant con artist and a bigamist, the subject of more than 50 lawsuits in Chicago alone. You see, Holmes was a man who was greedy, and like many greedy men, he simply couldn't get enough. But while some men had greed for wealth and power and influence, Holmes had greed for more than these things. Herman Mudgett had much more than a greed for wealth and power. He had a greed for being a criminal. Being a great con artist, or being a great bigamist, a man who was involved in multiple marriages at a time, and even several affairs, Holmes would no doubt have made a lot of enemies, and yet he continued and persisted, stayed free of the law despite all of the lawsuits leveled against him. Now, many now common stories of his crime sprang from fictional accounts that later authors took for fact. In a 2017 biography written by Adam Zeltzer, Zeltzer wrote that Holmes's story is effectively a new American tall tale, and like all the best tall tales, it sprang from a kernel of truth. Now, Holmes himself was executed only 9 days before his 35th birthday for the murder of his friend and accomplice Benjamin Pitzel. During his trial for the murder of Pitzel, Holmes confessed to numerous other murders. But this is only part of the story. We've only sort of crudely summarized this man. To truly understand a man like Holmes and his greed and aspirations of being a criminal lord, it's important that we dig down deep into his roots. We've talked a little bit about his humble beginnings, but there's more to his story. Before Hotel Hell, before the murder house, before the construction of his glorious castle and monument to death, before the murder of his accomplice, and before all the marriages, Holmes, too, was a child, like so many of you listening today. So, what was Herman Mudgett like as a boy? What sort of person was he? Now, as we mentioned, he was born in Gilmanton, New Hampshire, in May of 1861, to Levi Horton Mudgett and Theodate Page Price. Both of his parents were descended from the first English settlers who had landed in this area. Mudgett was his parents' third born child, and he had an older sister named Ellen and an older brother Arthur, a younger brother Henry, and a younger sister Mary. Such was not uncommon for families to be rather large. Holmes's father was from a farming family, and at times he worked as a farmer, a trader, and a house painter. His parents were devout Methodists. Later attempts to fit Holmes into the patterns seen in modern serial killers have described him torturing animals and suffering from abuse at the hands of a violent father, but contemporary and eyewitness accounts of his childhood provide proof of neither of these things occurring. At the age of 16, Holmes graduated from high school and took teaching jobs in Gilmanton and later in nearby Alton. In Alton, that he would marry Clara Lovering, and they would together conceive a son, Robert Lovering Mudgett, who was born on February 3rd, 1880, in Loudon, New Hampshire. As an adult, Robert became a certified public accountant and served as city manager of Orlando, Florida. And unlike his father, he would go on to have a long and healthy life. Holmes himself enrolled in the University of Vermont in Burlington at the age of 18, but he was dissatisfied with the school, and he left only after a year. In 1882, he entered the University of Michigan's Department of Medicine and Surgery, and he graduated in June of 1884 after passing his examinations. While enrolled, he worked in the anatomy lab under Professor Herdman, then the chief anatomy instructor. Holmes had previously apprenticed in New Hampshire under Dr. Nahum White, a noted advocate of a process commonly referred to as human dissection. Years later, when Holmes was suspected of murder and claimed to be nothing but an insurance fraudster, he admitted to using cadavers to defraud life insurance companies several times while he was in college, collecting sums from people's life insurance policies on behalf of their families, killing people and collecting the insurance titles on their lives. Housemates described Holmes as treating his wife, Clara, rather violently. And in 1884, before his graduation, she moved back to New Hampshire and later wrote that she knew little of him afterward. After he moved to Moores Forks, New York, a rumor spread that Holmes had been seen with a little boy who had later disappeared. Holmes, however, claimed that the boy went back to his home in Massachusetts. No investigation would take place, but Holmes would quickly leave town. Before we continue on, Holmes to his inevitable, along his inevitable killing spree in Chicago, I think now is the perfect time to take a commercial break. Pardon me. For those of you who are just joining us today, important for me to let you know that we here at Totally Driven have a proud new sponsor. He's funny, he's wacky, he's crazy, and he is Totally Driven. Come for some awesome comedy. We'll see you guys after the break, and we will trace Holmes' journey to the creation of his death house.
I'm Black Man, baby man's eyes, one stereotype at a time.
To the Black Mother. To the corner of Martin Luther King Street and Malcolm X Boulevard, pronto.
Will Black Man make it to the crime on time? Or will he be on CPT? Stay tuned at ChrisFarleyPresents.com.
Attention business owners, website owners, event promoters, or anyone looking to promote your product. The Totally Driven Entertainment Radio Network is a perfect way to spread the word of your business around the world. That's right, you can advertise at our network and be played on all of our shows at rates that are so cheap, it's a no-brainer. For more information, contact Bay Ragney at bayragney@gmail.com. To keep your business driven, stay driven with Totally Driven Entertainment.
Are you a fan of Sherlock Holmes? Letters from Holmes offers unique, one-of-a-kind letters from the world-famous detective himself. Handwritten on 8.5-inch by 11-inch aged parchment paper and using smudge-free ink to produce original, high-quality letters that fans will treasure for years to come. Each letter is handcrafted and written from the perspective of Sherlock Holmes, mimicking Holmes' native tongue and embracing many of the famous detective's quirks, quips, insults, and peculiarities. Order a love letter, birthday greeting, personal correspondence, or more only at www.etsy.com/shop/lettersfromholmes.
For $5 today, you can buy a wealth of things. Gas for your car, rent a movie for the family, a few slices of pizza. $5 still takes you a long ways. But did you know that $5 can buy your child a bag of heroin in the streets? That's right. For only $5, your son or daughter can buy some of the cheapest and purest dope in the country. Be aware of the lies. Be aware of the stealing. Be aware that's all it takes to kill your child. $5. This message was brought to you by Casey's Cause, a group of parents located in Southern Chester County out to save your child's life. Come join us today at www.caseyscause.com. And remember, $5 is all it takes. Casey's Cause, www.caseyscause.com.
Looking for that perfect gift for your cool friend? Then look no further than Teddy Scares. Teddy Scares are available in a variety of styles, sizes, and prices for all your shopping needs. Teddy Scares are a mix of cute and creepy to make a great gift for almost any age. Board up your windows, lock your doors, and log on to TeddyScares.com. And be sure to become our friends at Facebook.com/TeddyScares.
Calling all comic book fans. Do you collect comics? Did you ever collect comics? Do you think your children might like reading comic books? Do you even know they still print real, paper, non-digital comic books? Well, then visit the Pirates of Ontario Street Comics in Philadelphia. We have a massive collection of comic books, action figures, trading cards, and much more. We have one of the largest stocks of back-issue comics in the area. We bag and board every new comic book at no extra charge. Our store is voted the best comic book shop in the 2013 PHL 17 Hot List Contest. Part of the movie Unbreakable is filmed in our store. We are open 7 days a week. Ontario Street Comics is located at 2235 East Ontario Street in the Port Richmond section of Philly. Our phone number is 215-288-7338. Type in the words Ontario Comics Philadelphia to check out our wacky stores page on Facebook.
All right, everybody, welcome back. I hope you all enjoyed the commercials. Hope you guys found some interesting things. I do apologize for my throat there. Give me some problems. Ah, now, before we went to the commercial break, we talked more about Holmes's life before the murders, before the darkness overtook his soul. But it's only part of the story, right? There's always more to the story than meets the eye, and this murderer was no different. When we last left our man, Holmes, we had learned that he was quite violent towards his wife, Clara. And we learned that he had moved to New York before, where a young boy was reported missing. And before accusations could turn into investigations, Holmes skipped town. Following his abrupt departure from New York, he traveled to Philadelphia and eventually got a job as a keeper at Norristown State Hospital. But he quit after only a few days of work. Subsequently, he would take a position at a drugstore in Philadelphia, but while he was working there, a boy died after taking medication purchased at that store. Holmes denied any involvement in the child's death, but then immediately left the city. Once again, a young boy perhaps cut down in the prime of his youth, and Holmes's name tied to the murder, perhaps. But he leaves before investigations and questioning. It is unclear whether or not he claimed these boys as his victims later, but he certainly felt the need accusations could be leveled against him. Now, right before moving to Chicago, he would change his name to Henry Howard Holmes to avoid the possibility of being exposed by victims of his previous scams, and perhaps to avoid being tied to the mysterious disappearance of a boy in New York. Or the untimely demise of another young man who had died after purchasing drugs in his drugstore. In his confession following his arrest, Holmes claimed that he had killed his former medical school classmate, Dr. Robert Leacock, in 1886 to claim insurance money on his life. But this proved to be false, as Dr. Leacock had died in Watford, Ontario, in Canada on October 5th, in 1889. In late 1886, while still married to Clara, Holmes married Myrtle Belknap, a young woman who had been born in October of 1862 in Pennsylvania. But they were married in Minneapolis, Minnesota. He would file for divorce from Clara a few weeks after marrying Murda, alleging infidelity on her part. But the claims could not be proven, and of course, as a consequence, the lawsuit he filed went nowhere. Surviving paperwork from the time indicated that she probably was never even informed that she was being divorced by her husband. In any case, the divorce was never finalized. It was, however, dismissed on June 4th in 1891 on the grounds of want of prosecution. There had been no evidence found to enforce the statements made and accusations made by Mr. Holmes on the infidelity that he claimed his wife had committed. Would have a daughter named Lucy Theodate Holmes, who was born on July 4th in 1889 in Englewood, Chicago. As an adult, Lucy would grow up to be a public school teacher. And Holmes would live with Myrta and Lucy in Wilmette, Illinois, but he would spend most of his time in Chicago tending to business. Holmes would then marry Georgiana Yoke on January 17th in 1894 on a trip to Denver, while still married to both Clara and Murda. Not only was our Mudgett, a.k.a. Mr. Holmes, greedy when it came to wanting money, apparently he was even more greedy when it came to relationships. He was simultaneously married to three women, two of whom we know already he had conceived children with. Children who went on to have prosperous lives, who lived and died as many of us shall do. But Holmes would arrive in Chicago, 1886, and there he came across Miss Elizabeth S. Holton's drugstore at the southwest corner of South Wallace Avenue and West 63rd Street in Englewood. There, Holton's would give a job to Holmes, and he proved himself to be a hard-working employee. Eventually, he even bought the store. Although several books portray Holton's husband as an old man who quickly vanished along with his wife, Dr. Holton was actually a fellow Michigan alum, yes, who only a few years older than Holmes. And both Holtons remained in Englewood throughout Holmes's life and survived well into the 20th century. So claims that Holmes had killed them are strictly fiction. But Holmes, nonetheless, would purchase an empty lot across from the drugstore where construction began in 1887 for a two-story mixed-use building. That same building referred to by Holmes as the castle, that building we mentioned earlier in the show. This building possessed apartments on the second floor and retail spaces in the ground floor, including a new drugstore on the first. Now, when Holmes declined to pay the architects or the steel company, Aetna Iron and Steel, they sued him in 1888. And in 1892, he would add a third floor, despite being under lawsuit by Aetna Iron and Steel. He told investors and suppliers that he intended to use it as a hotel during the upcoming World's Columbian Exposition, though the hotel portion was never fully completed. Furniture suppliers found that Holmes was hiding their materials, for which he had never paid, in hidden rooms and passages that he had designed throughout the building. Their search made the news, and investors for the planned hotel pulled out of the deal when a jeweler in the building showed them the articles. When the third floor caught fire on the night of August 13, 1893, only a few people were in the building, all employees and long-term residents. Holmes had, of course, taken insurance policies out on the building with at least four companies, all of which promptly sued him rather than pay, suspecting that Holmes perhaps had attempted to burn the building down. We mentioned young Julia Smith earlier in the show, and she was one of Holmes's earliest murder victims. She was also his mistress. She was the wife of Ned Ilseus Connor, who had moved into Holmes's building and began working at his pharmacy's jewelry counter. After Connor found out about Smith's affair with Holmes, he quit his job and moved away, leaving Smith and her daughter Pearl behind, devastated. Smith gained custody of Pearl and remained at the hotel, continuing her sultry and unseemly relationship with Mr. Holmes. Julia and Pearl would disappear on Christmas Eve of 1891, and Holmes himself later claimed that she had died during an abortion, though what truly happened to the two of them was never confirmed. Another likely Holmes paramour, Emmeline Singrande, began working in the building in May of 1892 and disappeared in December of that same year. Another woman by the name of Edna Van Tassel also vanished, and it is believed that she too may have been one of Holmes's victims. While working in the Chemical Bank building on Dearborn Street, Holmes met and became close friends with Benjamin Chittisle, a carpenter with a criminal past who was exhibiting in the same building a coal bin which he had invented. Holmes used Chittisle as his right-hand man for several criminal schemes. A district attorney later described him as Holmes's tool, his creature, the Igor to his Frankenstein. Early 1893, a one-time actress named Minnie Williams moved to Chicago. Holmes claimed to have met her in an employment office, though there were rumors that he had met her in Boston some years earlier. He offered her a job at the hotel as his personal stenographer, and a woman such as herself, down on her luck in a hard town, accepted. Holmes was able to persuade Williams to transfer the deed to her property in Fort Worth, Texas, to a man named Alexander Bond, another convenient alias of Mr. Holmes himself, a phantom. In April of 1893, Williams transferred the deed, with Holmes serving as the notary, and Holmes later signed the deed over to Chittisle, giving him the alias Benton T. Lyman. The next month, Holmes and Williams, presenting themselves as man and wife, rented an apartment in Chicago's Lincoln Park. Minnie's sister Nanny came to visit, and in July she wrote to her aunt that she planned to accompany brother Harry to Europe. Neither Minnie nor Nanny was seen alive after July 5th, 1893, and it is suspected that Holmes himself was the man to blame for this. Insurance companies pressing to prosecute Holmes for arson after the convenient fire that claimed his castle forced Holmes to leave Chicago in July of 1894. He would later reappear in Fort Worth, where he had inherited property from the Williams sisters. And since they had not presented themselves as alive, whole, and hale, why, clear that he was the sole inheritor. There he sought to construct another castle along the lines of his Chicago operation, once again swindling a number of suppliers. In July of 1894, Holmes was arrested and briefly incarcerated for the first time on the charge of selling mortgaged goods in St. Louis, Missouri. He was promptly bailed out, but whilst in jail, he struck up a conversation with a convicted outlaw by the name of Marion Hedgepit, who was serving a 25-year sentence. Holmes, in this moment, concocted a plan to swindle an insurance company out of $10,000 by taking out a policy on himself and then faking his death. He promised Mr. Hedgepit a $500 commission in exchange for the name of a lawyer who could be trusted. Holmes was directed to a young St. Louis attorney named Jephthah Howell. And Howell was in practice with his older brother, Alfonso Howell, who had no involvement with either Holmes or Chittisle. He was still suspicious. He also had no knowledge of their fraudulent activities, and this made him convenient. Jephthah Howell, however, found Holmes' scheme to be brilliant. Nevertheless, Holmes' plan to fake his own death failed when the insurance company became suspicious and refused to pay. Holmes did not press the claim, and instead he concocted a similar plan with Chittisle. And Chittisle himself agreed to fake his own death so that his wife could collect him a $10,000 life insurance policy, which she was to split with Holmes and Jephthah. The scheme, however, which was to take place in Philadelphia, called for Pettisil to set himself up as an inventor under the name of P.F. Perry, and then be killed and disfigured in a lab explosion. They'd thought of everything, you see, setting a body on fire with the use of benzene would be the important key element that would lead to Pettisil's. The plan was simple enough, but Holmes had come up with a better one. Holmes was supposed to find an appropriate cadaver to play the role of Pettisil. But instead of finding an appropriate cadaver, Holmes believed that Pettisil had overlived his usefulness. It was time for Pettisil to finally become truly useful. And instead of looking up an appropriate cadaver for his young friend, Holmes killed him by knocking Pettisil unconscious with chloroform and then, as I briefly mentioned before, setting his body on fire. The use of benzene. In his confession, Holmes implied that Pettisil was still alive after he used the chloroform on him prior to being set on fire. However, forensic evidence presented at Holmes's later trial showed that the chloroform had in fact been administered after Pettisil's death, a fact which the insurance company was unaware of, presumably to fake suicide to exonerate Holmes should he be charged with murder. Holmes proceeded to collect the insurance payout on the basis of the genuine Pettisil corpse, and Holmes then went on to manipulate Pettisil's unsuspecting wife into allowing three of her five children, Alice, Nellie, and Howard, to be in his custody. The eldest daughter and the baby remained with Mrs. Pettisil. Holmes and the three Pettisil children traveled throughout the northern U.S. and into Canada. Simultaneously, he escorted Mrs. Pettisil along a parallel route, all while using various aliases and lying to Mrs. Pettisil concerning her husband's death, claiming that Pettisil was hiding in London, as well as lying to her about the true whereabouts of her three missing children. In Detroit, just prior to entering Canada, they were only separated by a few blocks. In an even more audacious move, Holmes was staying at another location with his wife, who was unaware of the entirety of the affair. Holmes would later confess to murdering Alice and Nellie by forcing them into a large trunk and locking them inside. He drilled a hole in the lid of the trunk and put one end of a hose through the hole, attaching the other end to a gas line so as to asphyxiate the two young girls. Holmes would strip their bodies bare and bury them nude in the cellar of his rental house at 16 St. Vincent Street in Toronto, Canada. But Holmes had gotten sloppy. By the name of Frank Geyer would soon begin tracking Holmes. And before we get into the horrifying things that Mr. Geyer would find, I think it's time we take one more commercial break. And as always, important for me to mention to you all that we do have a proud new sponsor of Totally Driven Entertainment. He's funny, he's wacky, he's crazy, and he's totally driven. Check out ChrisFreelyPresents.com. And guys, when we come back, we'll talk about Frank Geyer, the detective who became suspicious, the detective who tracked down a notorious killer. And when we come back, we you all to call in and ask questions. As always, the call-in number is 718-508-9883. Believe me, I'm dying to hear from you.
I'm Black Man. Baby Man died. One stereotype at a time.
To the Black Mother. To the corner of Martin Luther King Street and Malcolm X Boulevard. Pronto.
Will Black Man make it to the crime on time? or will he be on CPT? Stay tuned at ChrisFraleyPresents.com.
Attention business owners, website owners, event promoters, or anyone looking to promote your product. The Totally Driven Entertainment Radio Network is a perfect way to spread the word of your business around the world. That's right, you can advertise at our network and be played on all of our shows at rates that are so cheap, it's a no-brainer. For more information, contact Bay Ragney at bayragney@gmail.com. To keep your business driven, stay driven with Totally Driven Entertainment.
Are you a fan of Sherlock Holmes? Letters from Holmes offers unique, one-of-a-kind letters from the world-famous detective himself. Handwritten on 8.5-inch by 11-inch aged parchment paper and using smudge-free ink to produce original, high-quality letters that fans will treasure for years to come. Each letter is handcrafted and written from the perspective of Sherlock Holmes, mimicking Holmes' native tongue and embracing many of the famous detective's quirks, quips, insults, and peculiarities. Order a love letter, birthday greeting, personal correspondence, or more only at www.etsy.com/shop/lettersfromholmes.
For $5 today, you can buy a wealth of things. Gas for your car, rent a movie for the family, a few slices of pizza. $5 still takes you a long ways. But did you know that $5 can buy your child a bag of heroin in the streets? That's right. For only $5, your son or daughter can buy some of the cheapest and purest dope in the country. Be aware of the lies. Be aware of the stealing. Be aware that's all it takes to kill your child. $5. This message was brought to you by Casey's Cause, a group of parents located in Southern Chester County out to save your child's life. Come join us today at www.caseyscause.com. And remember, $5 is all it takes. Casey's Cause. www.caseyscause.com.
Looking for that perfect gift for your cool friend? Then look no further than Teddy Scares. Teddy Scares are available in a variety of styles, sizes, and prices for all your shopping needs. Teddy Scares are a mix of cute and creepy to make a great gift for almost any age. Board up your windows, lock your doors, and log on to TeddyScares.com. And be sure to become our friends at Facebook.com/TeddyScares.
Calling all comic book fans. Do you collect comics? Did you ever collect comics? Do you think your children might like reading comic books? Do you even know they still print real, paper, non-digital comic books? Well, then visit the Pirates of Ontario Street Comics in Philadelphia. We have a massive collection of comic books, action figures, trading cards, and much more. We have one of the largest stocks of back-issue comics in the area. We bag and board every new comic book at no extra charge. Our store is voted the best comic book shop in the 2013 PHL 17 Hot List Contest. Part of the movie Unbreakable is filmed in our store. We are open 7 days a week. Ontario Street Comics is located at 2235 East Ontario Street in the Port Richmond section of Philly. Our phone number is 215-288-7338. Type in the words Ontario Comics Philadelphia to check out our wacky stores page on Facebook.
Welcome back, everyone. And I hope you've been enjoying the show. I know that I have. Now, before we left, we talked about the brutal murder of his best friend and criminal associate, Mr. Pittisall. We talked about Holmes' scam to get the insurance money from Pittisall's family and the brutal murder of Pittisall's children. But we also mentioned the beginning of Mr. Holmes' end. Mr. Frank Gaio, a Philadelphia detective, found the decomposed bodies of the two Pittisall girls in the Toronto cellar. After removing their bodies from the shallow graves, Gaio noticed that Nellie's feet had been removed. After discovering that Nellie had clubfoot, he theorized that Holmes had cut off her feet to prevent a distinctive identification of her body. But the lack of something prompted the search of everything, followed Holmes to Indianapolis, where Holmes had rented a cottage. There, Holmes was reported to have visited a local pharmacy to purchase the drugs which he used to kill Howard Pittisall, and a repair shop to sharpen the knives he used to chop up the body before he burnt it. The boy's teeth and bits of bone were discovered in the Holmes chimney. Holmes' murder spree finally ended on November 17th in 1894 after being arrested in Boston. After being tracked there from Philadelphia by the Pinkertons. And if you're not certain who the Pinkertons are, the Pinkerton National Detective Agency is actually a private agency that was established in the United States by Alan Pinkerton in 1850 and is currently, today, a subsidiary of Securitas AB. They're a private security guard and detective agency now. But Pinkerton himself became famous when he claimed to have foiled a plot to assassinate President-elect Abraham Lincoln, who later hired Pinkerton agents for his personal security during the Civil War. Pinkerton's agents performed services ranging from security guarding to private military contracting work. Pinkerton was the largest private law enforcement agency in the world at the height of its power. But that is a story for another day. It is that they were instrumental in Holmes' date with the hangman. Now, at the time, Holmes was on an outstanding warrant for horse theft in Texas. As the authorities had become more suspicious at this point, and Holmes appeared poised to flee the country in the company of his unsuspecting third wife. Following the discovery of Alice and Nellie's bodies in July 1895, Chicago police and reporters began investigating Holmes's building in Englewood, now commonly and locally referred to as the Castle. Though many sensational claims were made, no evidence was found there which could have convicted Holmes in Chicago. According to Seltzer, stories of torture equipment found in the building are 20th century fiction. But in October of 1895, Holmes was put on trial for the murder of Benjamin Pitezel and was found guilty and sentenced to death. But by then, it was evidence that Holmes had also murdered the Pitezel children. And following his conviction, under interrogation, Holmes would confess to 27 murders in Chicago, Indianapolis, and Toronto, though, again, some persons he confessed to murdering were in fact still living, and 6 attempted murders, in addition to the 27 murders he claimed. How Holmes himself was paid $7,500, worth $216,000 today, roughly, by the Hearst newspapers in exchange for his confession, which was quickly found to be mostly nonsense. Holmes would give various contradictory accounts for his life, initially claiming he was possessed by the devil. His propensity for lying has made it rather difficult for researchers to ascertain the truth on the basis of his statements. And while writing his confessions in prison, Holmes mentioned how drastically his facial appearance had changed since his imprisonment. He described his new grim appearance as gruesome and taking on a satanical cast, and wrote that he was now convinced that after everything that he had done, he was beginning to resemble the devil. Truly a twisted individual. Now, finally, to see justice done, before we find out the ultimate fate of Mr. Holmes, I should like to share a quote from the man himself. or at least I should say, one believed to have been attributed to him. Now, it is believed that during this confession, Holmes was quoted as saying, "I was born with the devil in me." Some people, particularly his biographers, believe that this was something that they perhaps misremembered in his speaking. But the full quote that they attribute to H.H. Holmes is that "I was born with the devil in me. I could not help the fact that I was a murderer no more than the poet can help the inspiration to sing. I was born with the evil one standing as my sponsor beside the bed wherein I was ushered into the world, and he has been with me since." Now, it's been debated as to whether or not this is truly what Holmes said verbatim, but nonetheless, we know that towards the end, Holmes was somewhat obsessed with the idea of the devil. Perhaps all of his terrifying actions that he committed, all the atrocities that he'd committed, and even the ones that he'd claimed to have committed, perhaps they poisoned him so much that he truly believed he was a devil. And judging by the actions he took against Pitezel and his children, we'd be hard-pressed to disagree. On May 7th of 1896, Holmes would meet his end. He was hanged at Moyamensing Prison, also known as the Philadelphia County Prison, for the murder. And this was for the murder of Pitezel. Until the moment of his death, Holmes remained calm and amiable, showing very few signs of fear, anxiety, or depression. Despite this, he asked for his coffin to be contained in cement and buried 10 feet deep, because he was quite concerned that grave robbers would steal his body and use it for dissection. Now Holmes received a quick death. For unlike so many that had walked that long walk to the gallows, Holmes's neck did not snap when the trapdoor sprang. Instead, much like the two poor girls he left to asphyxiate in a trunk, he strangled to death slowly, twitching for over 15 minutes before being pronounced 20 minutes later dead after the trap had been sprung. Now, on New Year's Eve of 1909, Hedgepeth, who had been pardoned for informing on Holmes, was shot and killed by Officer Edward Jerberic during a holdup at a Chicago saloon. One more rogue meeting his end. On March 7th of 1914, the Chicago Tribune reported that with the death of Quinlan, the former caretaker of the castle, the mysteries of the Holmes castle would remain unexplained. Quinlan himself had committed suicide by taking strychnine. His body was found in his bedroom with a note that cryptically read, "I couldn't sleep." Before we get into more of the details of the castle itself and the reasonings behind the caretaker's mysterious death, and his mysterious suicide in the castle following the death of H.H. Holmes, it's important to note that to this point, we've charted the life of a very dishonest and roguish individual, an individual who spent the majority of his time preying on the weak, and preying on those he believed he was more clever than. A man who carried himself with a sense of superiority, whose pride and obsession with manipulation led him to the gallows. Learn from his mistakes. Learn from the path that he chose. Those wicked souls who manipulate the innocent one day to receive their comeuppance. Intriguing that Kinlan remained at the castle after Holmes, the master, had left. The master of the house, the master of the castle, the lord of this creation, had not been in the castle for some years. No, he'd left. He had left Chicago in 1894, July of 1894, and yet Kinlan, the caretaker, had stayed up until 1914 before going home and killing himself, consuming a vial of strychnine. His note simply read, "I couldn't sleep." His surviving relatives had claimed that he'd been haunted for several months and was suffering from various delusions and hallucinations. The castle itself was mysteriously gutted by a fire in 1895 in August. According to a newspaper clipping from the New York Times, two men were seen entering the back of the building between 8 and 9 p.m., and about a half an hour later, they were seen exiting the building and rapidly running away. Following several explosions, the castle itself went up in flames. The gators found a half-empty gas can underneath the back steps of the building. But the castle itself proved to be much stronger in its foundations than perhaps those would-be demolitionists had originally believed. For the building survived the fire, and it too remained in use until it was eventually torn down in 1938. The site today is currently occupied by the Englewood branch of the United States Postal Service. Now, in 2017, amid allegations that Holmes had in fact escaped execution, Holmes' body was exhumed for testing. Due to his coffin being contained in cement, his body was found not to have decomposed normally. His clothes were almost perfectly preserved, and even his mustache was found to be intact. The body was positively identified as that of Holmes with his teeth, and then Holmes himself was reburied. This is according to the Associated Press. Now, the case itself was notorious in its time, and it received wide publicity in the international press. So now that we've reached the end of Holmes, we shall talk about his legacy. Interest in Holmes' crimes was revived in 2003 by Eric Larson's The Devil in the White City, Murder, Magic, and Madness at the Fair That Changed America, selling nonfiction books that juxtaposed an account of the planning and the staging of the World's Fair with Holmes' story. And his story has previously been chronicled in The Tortured Doctor by David Frank, written in 1975, The Scarlet Mansion, written by Alan W. Eckert in 1985, and Depraved, the shocking true story of America's first serial killer by Harold Schechter in 1994. In addition, The Monster of 63rd Street, Chapter in the Gem of the Prairie, an Informal History of the Chicago Underworld by Herman Asbury, were published in 1986, but originally published in 1940, also chronicles the story of H.H. Holmes. Asbury's account drew heavily on the 1890s tabloids and included several claims, such as the 200 victims figure, Holmes is killing Dr. Holton, and torture equipment found in the castle that, according to Zeltzer, the biographer for Mr. Holmes, were the products of his own imagination. However, Asbury's account was a major foundation for later retellings of Holmes, including Larson's, which quoted several portions of his account verbatim. 1874 novel, American Gothic, written by horror writer Robert Bloch, was a fictionalized and fantasized version of the story of Holmes. For those of you interested in taking a look at some of this literature, I would definitely recommend taking a look at the work of Robert Bloch. In 2003, cartoonist and illustrator Rick Geary published a graphic novel about Holmes titled The Beast of Chicago, The Murderous Career of H.H. Holmes. Seltzer created a comprehensive biography in 2017, The H.H. Holmes, True Story of the White City Devil, an attempt to separate fact from fiction and to trace how the story of his legend had grown. A documentary film, H.H. Holmes, America's First Serial Killer, was even released in 2004 and narrated by Tony Jay. The producer and director of the film, John Borowski, also wrote a book on Holmes entitled The Strange Case of Dr. H.H. Holmes. The UK's Channel 5 aired a documentary, Slaughtered at the Murder Hotel, on July 6th. He's even featured in the first season of History Channel's Haunted History TV series, airing in 2013, which was dedicated to Holmes and the Murder Castle. The series even concluded, another series, I should say, running from July 2017, I should say. The History Channel broadcast the 8-part limited series American Ripper, in which Holmes' descendant, Jeff Mudgett, attempts to link Holmes to Jack the Ripper and his case. The series concluded with an exhumation of Holmes' grave and the positive identification of his body. There's even an upcoming film based off of Eric Larson's book, Devil in the White City, and it's starring Leonardo DiCaprio as Holmes. It's set to be directed by Martin Scorsese, one of the most influential directors in Hollywood, and written by Billy Ray. It's based on the book that I mentioned by Eric Larson. The film will follow Daniel H. Burnham's construction of the 1893 World Fair, as well as Holmes' building of his hotel. So as we can see, not only was Holmes a very influential man by the standards of the time he lived in based on his crimes, not only was he incredibly infamous for the things that he did to people, the horrendous crimes he committed, but he's had a lasting legacy as a ghost story, a tall tale that Holmes was real. He's no tall tale. He is no American urban legend. While details of his life are still debated to this day, such as the number of victims that can truly be attributed to his grisly murders, one thing is for certain. Holmes did kill Mr. Pitizzle, and he most certainly killed two young girls. It's questionable to this day as to whether or not he was responsible for the disappearances of the two young boys, the death of the young boy in his drugstore, and the disappearance of the other in New York. It's questionable as to whether or not he was responsible for the murders of the two women who never left his hotel. Perhaps we shall never know what happened to those poor souls that entered the castle and never returned. Perhaps we shall never know how many poor souls he sold for a few pennies. But we do know that Holmes, in fact, sold bodies, formed dissections, and practiced their autopsies during these times. And it proved to be somewhat popular and profitable for this man to do so at the time. We know these things to be true. We know that Holmes was a violent man, a man who could not be trusted, a con artist who fell in love with his own legendary status, famous deeds, a man of exceptional cruelty who took delight in strangling young women and children. A man so greedy he would kill his own friend rather than take the time to go search out a cadaver to take his place. One thing is for sure, Herman Webster Mudgett, a.k.a. H.H. Holmes, was a vile and cruel man. A man who will live in infamy as one of America's first serial killers. And a man who met his end much the same way that some of his poor victims did. Whether or not Holmes truly believed that the devil was a motivator for him his entire life, Holmes didn't need a devil to terrible deeds that he performed on people. He needed no real help in murdering the individuals that he murdered. No, his only accomplices for crimes that he committed were fraud. Those accomplices that he had, those unsuspecting people looking to make a quick buck, looking to find some easy cash, looking to perhaps make their fortune, dig themselves out of a difficult time, killed anyone on his behalf, and certainly could not have fathomed that Holmes would murder them. We're left with a lot of questions when it comes to Mr. H.H. Holmes. We're left wondering how a man such as him could go run around free for so long. But it's important for us to remember that news didn't travel as fast as it does now. Fraud now, while he might escape for some time, it's very unlikely that he shall do so before being exposed. And certainly unlikely that he'll be able to start a completely new business after the other one tanks. No, it's clear that Holmes is a man born into a time that allowed him to prey on people at his leisure. A man who would not have thrived in our time. Of course, we like to think that. We like to think that a man such as Holmes could not elude us. That he could not elude us forever. True, he met justice. He met his end at the end of a rope. He met the hangman. And like so many of his victims, he strangled, gasping for air like those poor girls that he locked in a trunk to struggle, that he asphyxiated with gas. A fitting end for a monster. To die in much the same manner as those he had visited cruelty upon. Clearly, H.H. Holmes was a man who's had a significant ink in history, and no doubt, despite being the subject of many novels, he's had a tremendous impact on criminal history. But one thing is also for certain. He's a man that will live in, whose legacy, I should say, shall live in infamy, for he is no longer alive. But he's a man whose legacy shall live on in history in infamy for many, many years to come. For during the construction of the castle, informally called the Murder Hotel, place where Holmes began to torture and kill poor souls who fell under his spell, his enchanting voice, his cunning personas, a master convincer that led poor souls like lambs to the slaughter and took his pick from the dead. He'll forever be linked to the World's Fair because of the things he did during 1893. Ladies and gentlemen, I hope you've enjoyed the show today. I hope you've learned a lot about H.H. Holmes and learned a little bit about piece of American history, a slice of Americana. And as we approach the Thanksgiving holiday, you get a simple slice of horror American pie. Only this one shall fill our dreams instead of our bellies. This one shall haunt our nightmares instead of our footsteps. Today we recounted and regaled you with the story of H.H. Holmes, a man born in Gilmanton, New Hampshire, whose journey of blood and his cravings for power, influence, and wealth, whose arrogance and manipulations and machinations led to his eventual downfall, but not before he betrayed those closest to him, not before he committed grievous and grisly murders to slack his lust to feel powerful. I hope you've enjoyed this story, as much of it as can be enjoyed. And before I departure, that you may take to heart I recommend that you take a look at the Holmes Pitezel case, conducted by Detective Frank P. Geyer. You might also want to take a look at Herman Webster Mudgett, Dr. H.H. Holmes, The Beast of Chicago, by Caitlin McClure, Tiffany Lewis, Rebecca Kearns, the Department of Psychology in Radford University. Easy enough to get your hands on. If you want a more entertaining version of the tale than these would offer you, you might take a look at Eric Larson's The Devil in the White City. You may also take a look at the H.H. Holmes America's First Serial Killer documentary. And of course, I'd recommend taking a look at H.H. Holmes' The True History of the White City Devil by Adam Zeltzer. I hope this has been informative for you. And before I depart, I'd like to remind you all that for the rest of this week, I shall be doing no more shows until Sunday. Straight Football Talk at 9 a.m. Eastern Time to 12 p.m. Eastern Time. And I hope you'll all accompany me there. Truly, I do. I hope you all are there. The subject material, I can promise you, will be a lot lighter. But for those of you who prefer the macabre, I have good news as well. For my upcoming show, which will take place next Wednesday, we will be returning to the realm of nightmares together. Yes, my upcoming show is going to be one for the ages. And for those of you who've enjoyed today's episode, well, you're truly going to enjoy the next one, I think, just a little bit more. For now that we've stayed together in Hotel Hell, this legendary murderer, but now we're going to get to a much more modern killing. A monster that haunted the footsteps of many unfortunate souls in more recent times. Next Wednesday, November 29th, we'll be discussing the story of Richard Ramirez. He's one of the most notorious and terrifying murderers in all of American history, and earned himself the moniker, the Night Stalker. Richard Ramirez earned his name through the violent deeds he committed against those poor, unfortunate souls who fell prey to his murderous rampage. Under the cover of the Night Stalker killer would give us reason to fear. He is the reason we would lock our doors. He was the reason that Mommy and Daddy told you to get home before the streetlights came on. Oh, yes. Next week didn't strike your fancy. Then November 30th, Totally Driven Entertainment is going to have a lighter show on the docket, as they remember Evel Knievel. We're going to be dedicating an entire show, a three-hour slot, to the discussion of Evel Knievel and its great impact on American history. There'll be special guests. There'll be discussion from people who knew Evel. And they're going to talk about his influence on the world of daredevils, but also how he became a true American icon. Of course, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that TDR Rocks tomorrow at 8 o'clock is having Thanksgiving with the Tube Freaks. And it's going to be a good time. It's going to be great. It's not going to be macabre at all. At least I don't think so. It could be. It might be. I don't know yet. Don't know what's going to happen there. And then finally, as if you thought it couldn't get any better, there's more. Because next Friday on the 1st of December, we will return to the macabre with my show, because we will be talking about the infamous Son of Sam killer from 5 to 6:30. So next Friday, December 1st, the Bareback Facts will talk about the Son of Sam killer. He's one of the most terrifying figures in American history. David Berkowitz is the name that some of you might recognize, but he's often referred to as being called the Son of Sam, a man who claimed that the howling of hounds drove him to commit grisly murders, a man who stalked the footsteps of hikers and joggers in the middle of the night, 70s, before he was eventually brought to justice. And I want to tell you all that it's okay to be afraid. They were afraid too. I'd be remiss, however, if I didn't mention some of the other events coming up on the schedule, because in addition to the shows that you're normally accustomed to, we'll also be having the Totally Driven Radio Best of 2017 Awards Show on December 14th from 8 to 11. It's going to be exciting. It's going to be a good time. We're going to be talking to a founding member of the and this is going to be great because there's going to be loads of going to be great guests on the show. They're going to have the founding members, the founding member of Manhattan Transfer, Aaron Dickens, who has got a new album called Vignettes coming out. Actress Loretta Swit, who's known for her work as Hot Lips on the iconic show MASH. Plus Kristen Burt for all the happenings in and around Hollywood. Plus Bay Ragney is going to be there. Nick and Janity will also be there talking about life and entertainment, TV, music, and more. So it's going to be a great time. Should be a great show. It's going to be very exciting. Lots of good stuff going on. And then finally, another thing that's come up on the schedule is TDR Rock's Top 25 Songs of 2017. And this is going to be on December 17th. Bay Ragney is going to be talking about new music that's coming out. And, of course, he's going to be going down the list of the top 25 rock songs of the year. So it's going to be exciting. It's going to be a good time. Lots of cool events coming up for Totally Driven. Thanks for tuning into the Bareback Facts today, guys. See you all on Straight Football Talk Sunday. And don't forget, Sunday's edition of Straight Football Talk is especially special because this Sunday we're going to have a special guest, Marquez Ogden, former offensive lineman for the Baltimore Ravens, Jacksonville Jaguars, and a few other teams. We're going to be talking to him, and we're going to be talking about his brother, another big guy who played in the NFL. So lots of cool stuff coming up in the near future, guys. We're always looking to get bigger, better, faster, stronger as it goes. That's all I've got for you guys today. Thanks for tuning into the show, and I hope you guys enjoyed it. This has been a Totally Driven Entertainment production, and I will see you all very soon.